Hi, I'm Suni Khalid, an editor in the KALW newsroom. At KALW, we make radio by the Bay, for the Bay, and just a few times a year, we ask you for your support. We share news that tells the stories of the communities that make the Bay Area such a unique place. You can contribute online at KALW.org. Click donate, and thank you.
KALW.
We spent some time together, like walking around Market Street, exploring like abandoned places. And then as like a half joke, I was like, we just play on BART. And then she was like, actually, that's a really good idea.
A Bay Area band takes public performance to a new level.
These kids took it upon themselves to like create their own scene and create their own community within the punk community. This is a young person's game. So like this new breed of bands, the energy and the drive that they have, like the future is looking golden.
Today, we're checking out the DIY punk scene. Then we talk to Rich Walkoff about the demise of the Pac-12 conference.
What we see is an administration that is looking at bottom line, not what's best for student athletes.
That's coming up. I'm Suni Khalid in for Hanan Baba, and this is Cross Currents. From our new series, Culture Keepers, celebrating the communities of the Bay Area.
I was very much fascinated by bells and lights and whistles.
It's my role to learn it well and protect it and keep it.
Alors, je vais faire l'explication en anglais. Soyez tolérants.
Just the energy and the drive that they have, like the future is looking f***ing golden.
We'll hear from musicians, event organizers, and people in the hardcore and punk scene who are playing a role in keeping its DIY culture alive.
I am Paloma Abarca.
I'm Keon Sherman.
And it's Friday, January 6, 2023, and the young band Surprise Privilege and False Flag took Bay Area public transportation by storm. Something that started as a joke ended up being one of the most talked about DIY shows to happen on BART, as they invited fans to join them for a ride.
Logistically, this is a nightmare, you know what I mean? It's gonna be multi-car, I feel like.
Personally, I think this is the most stupid thing that we've ever done as punks in the Bay Area, but it is also one of the coolest I've ever done.
Their journey began at 16th Street and Mission around 7 p.m. At Dublin Pleasanton, they turned around, filling about three train carts on their way back to the city.
Keon and I spoke with the band, Surprise Privilege, to see what inspired them to host a show of this caliber.
My name is Cody. I am the founder, CEO of Surprise Privilege, LLC.
My name is Joey, founder, CEO of Surprise Privilege.
Hello, my name's Alan. I play drums with Surprise Privilege.
Because if you think about it, a full-on punk show on BART? It's pretty wild.
Myself and Pretty from the band False Flag were talking about this, and we both felt like it got a little stagnant to be having shows at the same place every time, because it just felt like part of the appeal of DIY shows is that like there's a sort of thrill in knowing like, oh, this is not a proper venue, we're not really supposed to be doing this here, haha.
You know, if you've been on BART often enough, you've likely seen live music there, but what these bands did was seriously on another level. Other people may have considered doing it, but they were the first, and it was executed to perfection.
We spent some time together, like, walking around Market Street or something, and exploring, like, abandoned places. And then I was just like, as like a half joke, I was like, we just play on BART. And then she was like, that would be funny. Actually, that's a really good idea. Everyone in the bands just grabbed gear and walked on and did it.
Punk has always been about doing it yourself. And although some venues have been of great support to the scene, like 924 Gilman in Berkeley and CBGB's in the East Coast, it's important to note that those venues originated from the DIY ethos, which has always been the backbone of punk and hardcore culture.
These people are building communities through the kinds of zines they make and the clothes they wear and the shows they book. The key part is that it's the younger generation keeping this music scene alive. And when it comes to the Bay Area's hardcore and punk community, our story really begins with 924 Gilman. In the context of this music's history, you just can't not talk about the music venue because it shaped so much of the culture and community at the time.
You know, as punk and hardcore continued to evolve in the 80s and the 90s, the Bay Area remained a hub for do-it-yourself activity, with bands like Operation Ivy, Green Day, The Offspring, and Rancid rising to national prominence.
We then spoke to Alex Botkin, the head booker and coordinator for 924 Gilman.
A lot of us wear kind of many hats in it. The primary thing is kind of putting the show lineups together and making sure like the staff knows when to be there.
It's easy to talk about the history of punk music and DIY ethos the old school punk venue abided by, but the thing that stood out in recent history was how impactful COVID-19 was.
It devastated it. We lost so many venues and so many bands just in terms of, like I was saying, they'd moved or decided to stop playing, or it's been the worst thing that could have ever happened.
Founded in 1986, the legacy of 924 Gilman will always be remembered, since it served as a catalyst in the fame and a space where many punk bands had their very first show. But the footprint of Bay Area punk and hardcore DIY culture lives on, regardless of COVID's recent impact on venues.
In fact, it encouraged and pushed forth the DIY ethos. You know, the idea you can do it all yourself, host your own shows, create your own venue spaces. And Alex even recognizes the spirit of independence is really prominent within the scene right now.
There are kids now that have found their own ways of doing shows and DIY music and things like that. And with the BART show that happened with Surprise Privilege and False Flag, like, okay, there's kids that are just making music and shows happen where they want to.
These young punk and hardcore bands in the DIY scene are finding music venues less and less necessary as they increasingly rely on their own resources to put on shows.
Our interview with Surprise Privilege really shed light on the onset of post-lockdown DIY shows.
In 2021, like the summer where lockdown was lifted and a lot of people were like, you know, allowed to go outside and like hang out in places, we started hosting a lot more shows in the park.
Despite the lockdown, Surprise Privilege and False Flag weren't the only ones to take advantage of the uptick of DIY shows happening throughout the Bay Area. I got together with Greg because he was hosting an infamous Oakland DIY punk festival for 2 days with two stages and back-to-back bands for 5 hours straight.
People know me as Greg Deadface, and I'm just a dude in a band that loves f***ing playing music. I just love being part of an independent DIY underground musical community. I love the ethics and the values and the morals that I've learned and have carried with me throughout the years.
As Greg spoke with Keon, he painted a picture of a gate-kept punk scene in 2016 to a pandemic that furthered, quote, blood pits and rage into the underground, end quote, DIY scene, to what's now become people doing their own things.
These kids took it upon themselves to like create their own scene and create their own community within the punk community. This is a young man's game, young person's game. So like this new breed of bands and kids and just the energy and the drive that they have, like the future is looking fucking golden.
Although the culture of the DIY punk scene will continuously change, the scene has not only documented the past and the present, but it's inspired and empowered a new generation to continue the spirit of DIY creativity and rebellion in their own unique ways.
Those were reporters Paloma Abarca and Kian Sherman. Special thanks to Cody, Joey, and Helen from Surprise Privilege, as well as Greg and Alex Botkin. We use audio from A Crafted Pixel, video of the punk show on BART, and Slicer Sound Apparatus Archive provided tape of the side stage at 510 Grindfest. One of the songs we used was by False Flag, and the music currently playing is a band called Love, L-U-V. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Suni Khalid in for Hanna Baba. earlier this month, the much-anticipated college football season kicked off, full of primetime matchups and traditional rivalries, culminating next January in the national championship game. But this season is bittersweet for fans of the Pacific Athletic Conference, which has suddenly collapsed after 108 years, with 10 of its 12 member schools, including Cal and Stanford, abandoning the conference for multi-million dollar television deals elsewhere. What led to the Pac-12's sudden demise? All right, I'm here with Rich Walkoff, who's a longtime sports broadcaster, actually covered Cal for many years, both football and basketball.
Not just covered. I was the voice of Cal basketball for a few years in the late 80s, early 90s, and color commentary for Cal football in the early 90s.
With?
Joe Starkey, the recently retired legendary voice of Cal Bears. What a bonanza!
We have already begun what may be the last year in the history of the venerated Pacific Athletic Conference. This time last year, it was the Pac-12. Now there are only two schools left, Washington State and Oregon State. What happened in the last year?
This is a really bizarre saga, and very soon, in all likelihood, the Cougars and the Beavers, those are two aforementioned schools, are bound for Mountain West Conference, so the Pac-12 will be zero. It will be no more. 108 years, legendary, iconic, the Conference of Champions. Stanford has won the Director's Cup for most national titles in their athletic programs almost year after year, I think 30 of the last 32 years. Cal has had a great run in so many sports, football not among them of late. Anyway, you had the Pac-12 run by Larry Scott for a dozen years from 09 to 2021 or so, and he misplayed his hand. There was an opportunity to bring Texas and Oklahoma into the Pac-12. Instead, now we see the demise and the departures of these iconic schools and programs running for the money. But does it surprise anybody that Oregon, Washington, USC, and UCLA would go to the Big Ten, which could bring them media rights close to double what they were receiving as a Pac-12 member, about $30 million, and it's going to be $50 to $60 million in the ensuing years for those schools. And for Arizona, Arizona State, Colorado, and Utah to go to the Big 12, they too will get a big bump from $30 million a year in media rights to about $40 million. So the old Bob Dylan line of money don't talk, it swears, raises its ugly head again. But does it surprise you in any way with the media rights being so exorbitant and now the ACC, which is getting Cal and Stanford.
And SMU.
Yes, but Cal and Stanford are going to take reduced media rights fees or media rights benefits for the number of years with the hope that it would be bountiful enough down the road to reach $35 to $40 million a year.
Why would they improbably join the ACC as opposed to going with the Big Ten where the money is much larger?
Well, I don't think the offer was there, A, and B, well, that's it. I don't think the offer was forthcoming. It would be much more advantageous from a prestige and a Power 5 conference vision for Cal and Stanford to be in the Big Ten with their former Pac-12 rivals and league mates, but that's not in the offing. So now you have not only the demise of the West Coast's premier conference, you have a geographic anomaly. You have coast-to-coast flights for virtually all your events. 3,000 miles away, 14 of the 15 schools in the ACC are in the Eastern time zone. Louisville is as close as you're going to get. So now they're talking about using Dallas, which is where SMU is, as kind of a midway hub. Well, who the heck is going to go watch a water polo, a baseball game at a neutral site 1,500 miles from the respective schools, unless you're SMU, right? I mean, that's your home city. But if you're Florida State, NC State, North Carolina, Duke,
Clemson,
sure. It's 1,500 miles for them to get to Dallas. It's 1,500 or so miles for the Bay Area schools to get there. So this is, you know, a very unfortunate thing. But you look at the big picture of what money has done in sports, and you'd think that the college venue would be either exempt or in some way above that. But LIV Golf, taking the PGA in alignment with the Saudis and all that blood money, right?
Sports washing.
Sports wash. And you look at the World Cup with FIFA bribes with Qatar getting the games when millions of dollars were lining the pockets of the people deciding who's going to host the World Cup. Look at Major League Baseball turning a blind eye for the PEDs in the steroid era because the turnstiles were spinning and the money was flowing and the TV revenues were up after the strike and then the lockout of 94, which lost the World Series. And then when McGuire and Sosa and company had that great home run race, juiced out of their gourds in 1998, baseball said, what are you talking about? I see no evil, right? And in the NFL, they've been fighting their financial obligations for older players, retired players who suffered terrible injuries and concussions and the like, and CTE. They fought it tooth and nail. So does it surprise you that the big money has infiltrated the heretofore so-called amateur sports world of college athletics? No, it doesn't, because it's huge money.
All right, well, speaking of money, let's bring this back a little bit closer to the Bay Area. Cal is really up against it as far as revenue. They had to make a move, didn't they?
Well, they did because they have $350 million indebtedness for the refurbishing of Memorial Stadium. And there's balloon payments on that debt that will go up to 20 or more million a year. And media rights is what drives the bus. There's over 30% of the athletic department's budget comes from media rights, predominantly from football. Now, Cal's not winning on the field. They're not winning at the gate. Their attendance is down, but it becomes a business. And Stanford, with the second largest endowment of any university, I think, in the world, $36 billion, doesn't have the same financial crunch as a public university like Cal, but they too are thinking bottom line. And they're going to get more money in the ACC than they would get in the Mountain West. So that's why they took that path. But what's so unfortunate is that, you know, a few years ago, Cal wanted to drop the baseball program. And the alumni and supporters and fans were outraged, and it was resurrected. Stanford unilaterally wanted to eliminate a wrestling program and others. And that was, you know, one of the most extraordinary programs in the country. And thankfully, they were saved. But what we see is an administration that is looking at bottom line, not what's best for the university in a large sense, and not what's best for student athletes. Emphasis on student. They're just looking at bottom line. And I understand the dilemma. University of Washington, they refurbished Husky Stadium, beautiful facility on the water in Seattle. But they too are going to have $17 to $20 million debt service in the next few years. That's why they jumped at the big money offer at the Big Ten. So you see what's driving this bus. And, you know, history be damned, regional rivalries be damned, fans be damned, because we just lose a lot of tradition because of the economics.
All right, Mr. Wolkoff, you grew up on Long Island near New York City.
Yes.
And you grew up when there were actually three major league teams in New York. There was...
Yeah, I was a little boy when the Giants and Dodgers left. I don't even remember it because I was about 5, 6 years old.
All right, well, I was an embryo.
You okay. Even less conscious than I was.
Yeah, less conscious. But the year before I was born, the Giants came out to San Francisco and the Dodgers came out to Brooklyn. What about the loss to the fans, the nostalgia? Is it tangible for the Cal fans, the Stanford fans, or other fans who grew up in the Pac-12?
Well, I think it will be. And I remember growing up in the 60s in New York and going to my friend's house and the Giants were on. The San Francisco Giants were on TV. And my buddy's dad was still a huge Willie Mays fan, still a Giants fan. And a lot of people kept their allegiance, even though the teams went 3,000 miles away and left them in the lurch. It's sort of like your ex-wife or girlfriend leaving you and you're still pining for her, even though she did terrible things to you. The heart does what the heart wants to do. So geography didn't change the allegiance that many longtime diehard Giants or Dodger fans had. And some of them, you know, followed those teams west, like many have. Yours truly, from New York to the Bay Area, you know, 40-some-odd years ago, and never looking back. But it's interesting, because I was a big Yankee fan as a kid, and now I don't give a hoot. Yeah, that was then, and now is now. But I think we saw things start to deteriorate in terms of the Pac-12 swagger, if you will, with the Pac-12 network doing so many funky things. You know, couldn't make a deal with DirecTV to have their programming carried by that subscriber, put the games on at night, demanded kickoffs at 7:30 p.m., the big game. Normally, beautiful afternoon affair down on the farm at Stanford or in Strawberry Canyon in Berkeley at 1 o'clock, 1:30. You tailgate, you'd hang out afterwards, go to dinner. Well, you're kicking off at 7:30. You're reaching almost the midnight hour with these games. But it was all driven by the lack of games that were prime time on the East Coast at that time. So they filled that void. It was TV driving kickoff times, and the Pac-12 had to play ball. But again, back to Larry Scott, the ill-fated former Pac-12 commissioner, he rebuffed ESPN's $30 million a school media deal a few years ago. And that, in retrospect, would have been serviceable on every level to keep the Pac-12 alive. Would UCLA and USC jumped at 40 to 50 million? Maybe so. But at least UCLA, there was a financial burden that when they bailed on the Pac-12 as a state school, they're required to pay. It's going to actually be from UCLA to Cal, because the only two public universities in the California system that were in the Pac-12. So there are poison pills for you to leave. But how's this for irony? The two highest paid public employees in the state of California are UCLA coach Chip Kelly at $6 million a year and Cal football coach Justin Wilcox at $5 million a year. Amateur sports? Student athletes first? No. Fill the stadium, win games, get the media rights, bring the cash in, pay the bills.
That was longtime Bay Area sports broadcaster Rich Walkoff speaking about the demise of the Pac-12. For Cross Currents, I'm Suni Khalid.